Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
December 29, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this, indeed, is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Well, because you found it. Anyway, it looks as though we may not be broadcasting live at the moment, but I do know we are being recorded, and now we're back to the live stream. Sorry about that, guys. These are the hazards of doing stuff live without a net and a blind guy producing, because not only am I the host of the show, well, what was that thing? I'm not only the hair club whatever, I'm also a client. Oh, I'm not only the hair club president, I'm also a client, right? I'm not only the announcer on this show, I'm also the producer. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it is Thursday, and all that good stuff, and I'm going to try and have a little bit of fun with our friend Mike Swanson in the first hour. Now, he's not just our friend, he's also the author of, well, quite a few books, but two that I always like to point out to you. The War State. Which is that red book you see in the sidebar at Ocelli.com. Highly recommended. Part of my reading list, my essential reading list, if you want to understand the geopolitical world around you. And well done. In fact, complex things about the history of things which went on in the 20th century. All combined in there and explained in a very discernible way. A very easily understood way, because that's Mike Swanson's writing style. And also Why the Vietnam War, which is the first in a series of three regarding that particular conflict. And again, complex issues explained in a unique way. And indeed, there is unique information in Why the Vietnam War, and I believe there will be more as Mike continues to write. And speaking of unique information, you can go over to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. And you can follow many a different news streams and strings, if you will. And it's very interesting. I also suggest you sign up for the emails over there. And not just because Mike is one of those listeners slash supporters of this show. Do I tell you all this? Because I used to point to Mike's work before him and I were even really in contact with one another. Because I just appreciated really great and accessible way he was allowing us to peer into real history. But anyway, great analyst. He's also written a book about Danville, Virginia, some financial books, etc. And I think he wrote a foreword to a book he released that his father had actually written regarding the Roman Empire. But that's a subject for another day, and believe me, we're going to get into all that at some point in time. Who knows what we're going to do in this first hour, but second hour tonight, I'm going to have Larry and Larry. So am I Mo or am I Curly yet? Well, I am O, but I guess I'll be O, and we won't have a Curly because I'll have two Larrys, and it's not going to be Three Stooges time. We're going to talk JFK, and we're going to discuss the lawsuit, which is ongoing against the Biden administration, the National Archives, etc. The JFK document dump, we're going to elaborate on that a bit more. Last week we gave you, I think, a very solid presentation regarding the media and what they did with it. But we're going to hear from the same guy that Tucker Carlson decided to have on, which is the co-counsel in that lawsuit. Okay. Except I actually know what questions to ask. I may not have to ask too many questions. And also, I didn't get briefed by the CIA ahead of time. Like, oh, excuse me, did I say that out loud? Yeah, okay, sorry. Anyways, it is what it is. Going to talk JFK in the second hour with, of course, one of the best experts on it, Larry Hancock, and the co-counsel, who is also a guy who studies the case, Larry Schnapp. And, you know, I know that's a hard name to pronounce and all. Maybe he'll help us out with that. And surprise, surprise, a lawyer that I don't hate, Larry Schnapp. Anyways, again, Bill Simpich's co-counsel in that lawsuit. But before we get there, like I said, Mike Swanson, always great to hear from you. Now, last week, you were under the weather, sir, and you sounded like you might still be a little bit under the weather this week. But first and foremost, how you doing tonight, Mike?
Oh, I've got a bad... I'm still coughing. I got a bad cold, so people have to bear with me. But, you know, since... I mean, I was thinking about this. You told me these guys are coming on after us, and, you know, there's so much going on in the JFK world and going to happen next year with the... 60th anniversary. Right. We had this Files release. And you did a great show with Larry Hancock. And the deal is, look, having them on, they are the experts. You know, they're not only the experts, but they're directly involved in this. This is now a legal case.
Right.
Larry Schnapp is one of the lawyers involved. So I wouldn't be shocked, Chuck, if the CIA goons, their lawyers, are listening to the show because they're going to be on next. And if that's the case, I mean, yeah. I just want them to know I'm not the big expert, but you can take me as a man in the street with some knowledge and yeah. use that to gauge public opinion.
I love this.
And I would just pose one question. I know you can't answer very many questions and certainly nothing that would expose any criminality, and I would not never ask anyone to do that. Mm-hmm. But look, last year a book came out.
Yes.
By a former CIA director, James Woolsey.
Yes.
And in this book, he was the, director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Mm-hmm. And he put out a book, and in his book, he claimed that Lee Harvey Oswald was part of an assassination plot on behalf of the Soviet Union and the KGB.
Right.
So the only question I got is if the CIA goons listening can pass it on and get answers to us, little people out here, why in the world is the CIA putting out disinformation like that?
Well, you know, we could have asked that question.
About the assassination.
Oh, I love it. I love it because we could have asked that question a couple of years ago. Remember when you and I actually around the time you and I formerly kind of partnered up to start doing your regular segments, there was a guy on one of the, I forget which one, if it was Discovery or History Channel, kind of irrelevant now which one it was. But, you know, former CIA guys got together and put out this whole series pretty much trying to say, well, you know, Oswald was indeed maybe some type of Russian agent, right? I mean, that was the big constant teaser as they released each episode. He may have had real legitimate links to Russia. Why is the CIA putting that out? And by the way, when James Woolsey or any of these, you know, here we go, I'm going to laugh. Former CIA people, you know, former in air quotes, for those of you playing at home, CIA people puts out a book. We must all remember that they are vetted by the agency. In other words, they have to read it before. This is one of the things you have to do as a former employee of the agency. You have to run your book by them before you show it to a publisher, before it gets released, all that. Otherwise, you are risking your freedom. You are risking even possible execution for treason if, you know, all of these things go on. If you reveal secrets, all kinds of problems you can have as a former CIA. Again, former in air quotes, not CIA, but former CIA in air quotes. Because I don't believe for a second that once you work for that agency, they ever actually let go of you. But that's my opinion. My editorial has nothing to do with Mike Swanson. And for the spooks listening, because I'm very sure they will be tonight, as per usual. We'll see the unknown, you know, somewhere in America or unknown person come up on the stream as a listener. I mean, you can see them. It's hilarious. Occasionally, they have a .gov address, which is even funnier. But all the time, I know that Homeland Security, Central Intelligence, all that stuff will tune in for stuff like this. And especially considering the fact that the administration, the current administration, the Biden administration, is being sued. The office of the president is being sued, which, you know, remember that contention, you can't sue a sitting president? False. Anyways, is being sued. The National Archives is being sued. The office of the person who controls the National Archives is being sued. You can do all this. Considering all that, it would almost be malpractice for them not to be listening, since they're the ones who have basically caused and advised everybody. The National Security Council, etc., has certainly advised them all. Okay? So I'm certain that they're listening. Maybe not live. Maybe they'll catch the podcast. But I can almost guarantee live listeners tonight from .gov addresses, whether they allow themselves to be identified or they think they're slick and using a VPN. Okay? So Mike Swanson would like you to know that he is not an expert on this subject and therefore does not want to be a target of any investigation. Thank you. But here's the thing. I already know that Homeland Security has an interesting file on me. I found that out. I told you that story, Mike. I'm not going to go through it again. But I already know that these people have an interesting file on me, and they've had one for many, many years. And they
they can look in their records and figure out that my father actually visited their headquarters once. So
sure.
He was a colonel in the service and did it as part of his job. But whatever. I'm being kind of humorous.
It's okay. Look, Mike, you know you're mentioned somewhere. You have associated with known problematic people, according to national security. I mean, you think nobody pays attention to what John Newman does? You've been in the same room with him. I know. I was there. So
yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's true. But the subject of these files, I haven't. You know, last year when they were released, it wasn't very many of them. It was less than 2,000. And because it was so few, I actually looked through most of them.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1,500, actually, 1,491. And I looked through them because it wasn't that many. And I was under the impression after having done that, that there was only a small number left.
Mm-hmm. Well,
2,000 or 3,000 that perhaps that had not been really released yet. And so that was the impression I got after looking at that.
I know. And I'm not laughing at you. Mike, I want you to know I'm not laughing at you. I'm just laughing at, obviously, you know, Larry and I broke this down, right, to explain.
Yeah.
And Rex Bradford, I don't know if you want a copy of that press conference or a couple of the press conferences, I have audio copies. If you'd like to take a listen to some
they're
of the things.
They're on YouTube, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, one of them I know was on YouTube, but I don't know. I made my own copies, okay? So, point is, though, that, look, this idea that they are pushing now, like Larry and I pointed out, they're pushing this idea there's very little left to see, and they're going to keep doing that. I'm about three-quarters of the way through this mess that they just dumped. Now, I'm not saying I have the most, educated eye regarding this, but I am familiar with the material to some degree, right? And the NSA stuff, which was not even a part of the collection, and a few other things outside of the NSA documents that were not even expected to be released, I don't know the contents of these things. These are unexpected. There are various things that have yet to be collected still that could be collected. There are things that are on the list to be collected that have not been collected. And therefore, the idea that there's only this finite amount of things left to be released is just incorrect on the face of it. And Rex Bradford really went and broke this down in a couple of different ways that I didn't just now to explain it to, the people from The Washington Post and Newsweek and
When they did this release December the 15th,
right.
And I looked at the National Archives press release, I was traveling and so I didn't have time to look through files and stuff,
sure.
But just reading the press release, and because I do stock market, investing and trading all my life, I'm used to misleading press releases where companies lose money and then they tell you they're making money and you just put the bad news, way at the bottom and hype things up at the start. And that was just the impression I got because they made this statement that some crazy 92% of the records are all now released.
Uh-huh.
And it looked like they were re-releasing
tons of
old records,
yeah.
Which is what, and then I heard that confirmed listening to you and Larry speak about this. So the impression I got, 2 weeks ago, I guess, was that this was like, a PR stunt. You know, perhaps whoever is behind it, their thought was, well, we'll just make these big numbers, throw them out there. The media will run with it because, well, that's another topic. But the media is depending on press releases to report on.
The easiest way to put that is, first of all, well-meaning people in the media don't know any better. And secondly, you know, even if they did know a little better, it's a whole lot of work you'd have to do to actually independently confirm this stuff. Who has time for that when you've got to cover everything else going on? You know, even if you're just the historical reporter with the Daily Beast or something, right? I mean, you don't have time to go through all this. So, they're going to rely on that. They're going to rely on the White House's statement, the National Archives statement. They did introduce this time, you know, the statement from, say, our side of the fence, right? You know, some of the stuff. And they always have to some degree, but it was usually to scoff at us and mock us. You know, and idiot conspiracy theorists, I'm paraphrasing, actually think this. You know, and they did include some of the things that we would actually think. And then some ludicrous statements would get mixed in, or it might come from, you know, some fringe element out
there. Well, I'm on kind of the... Well, today, before the show, I was looking, you know, the last second here, I'm looking at the press release they put out again, and now I'm getting the impression that there may be 3,000 or so records that have never been released, and they're completely withheld in full in the collection.
That's
now the impression I got.
Yeah, 3,000 or whatever.
And it's not clear. I mean, even that. It's hard to discern that from this single press release.
Well, but compared to the massive amount, like you and I both know, there are over 5 million documents, which is not pages, by the way. They kept saying pages because the briefing and the prepared statement that the government handed them, it said that 5 million pages was what was released already. That's inaccurate to begin with because a document is not necessarily a page. It can be. But it's usually not, Mike. You and I know this. So they're parroting the mistakes, like I showed in that mathematical equation, right? When I talked about how do you get 101% of anything? Okay, because they had, 7% and 8% and 93% were the two figures, right? So 101%. Congrats, guys. You can't do math. My point is that... They made all sorts of mistakes with this, and it's easily traceable. If you look at somebody originating, somebody who starts with that original statement and then, you know, prints it, and then somebody else who parrots it from there, you can see they all got it from the same source or were handed it from a tainted source. So you know immediately who didn't actually take a look at this for themselves and just went on the face of a statement. Very simple analysis for media analysis, and a lot of people think they analyze media. They don't because they never even stop to look at things like that. And I'm telling you, the majority of people that I even spoke to went right by this fact that they said, you know, how do you get 93% and 8%, you know, when you're trying to represent 100%? Well, because you made a mistake. Very simple. That's just one of the errors, by the way. There's more in there, but those are the easiest ones to point out. So anyway, back to this point, it's very interesting to me to see what the media is doing with this, partially out of ignorance and partially because they're accepting marching orders. And those two things combined, along with the narrative that they're pushing, the alternative explanation of, you know, maybe it was Russian, because right now Russia is a good, boogeyman du jour. So remember, he could have been a Russian agent. You know, they've been pushing.
Well, that in itself is interesting that, you know, that the former director of CIA is going to write a book saying that the Soviet Union was behind it. And, you know, his evidence is that this Kostikov figure in the Mexico City.
Yeah, right.
Cuban embassy there. But he, you know, when he was doing that book, he was doing interviews making out like this is new information. Well, it's not. It's
no,
that's
you
old
I,
Warren Commission information that they dealt with in 1964.
I don't know what year you read your first JFK book, but I'm going to tell you right now, in the first JFK books I ever read when I knew nothing, the Kostakov versus Kostin and who this was and the fact, all that information was available in the 1980s easily. I know that from reading it. So, you know, that was nothing new. And another funny thing is when something is going to happen and a new point of interest is about to come about, it's really funny to me how somebody who is somehow tied to the case emerges to present. Of course, they all come out and they want to support the Warren Commission conclusion. But just like when we had the HSCA and there was a bit of shocking information that came out, the moment they completed that report, which, you know, hardly anybody ever read, and they didn't expect people to read from Congress, from the congressional investigation, right? What was the next thing that happened sequentially as far as media releases go? The guy who ended up running the HSCA investigation then released his own book with his partner, right, who was also involved in writing the final report, stating what, in essence? The basic thesis? The mob killed JFK. Sure, there was a conspiracy, but the mob did it. And they sold that for the next decade, Mike, that, you know, the mob did it. The mob did it. And to this day, you got people going, well, I think the mafia might have done it. And I get it. Okay? Fine. But right now, it's on to the Russians. Okay? Because, I mean, how are you going to believe?
Well, we've moved on, you know, from the period of the Oliver Stone movie,
right,
where, you know, they were using, you know, they were labeling conspiracy theorists crazy, or saying you were a conspiracy theorist and nuts if you didn't believe Oswald did it, and Posner became a superstar, you know, for a year.
And they released his book. And when did they release his book? Right, all of a sudden, a guy who was a Wall Street lawyer had an entire body of work allegedly put together where he did his own research, and indeed he did conduct some interviews, but I mean, all of a sudden this guy put it together in like less than a year, a complete, you know, I have reinvestigated, and I realize the Warren Commission might have made a few mistakes, but the conclusion is right, Oswald did it.
Well, the thing is, and then you had John around that time, John McAdams and Big Lucy comes around, and four or five other smaller figures, Max Holland, who actually got, you know, look, I'm talking about the CIA here. I don't think they killed Kennedy. I want to flat out say that. There are people who, you know, that we both know that think that. Yeah. I'm not one of them.
And I'll state that I agree with you. I think that they have a level of involvement, but I don't think that you could absolutely lay it at the feet of the CIA. How about that? That's what I agree
with that statement. There you go. So, but, you know, Max Holland was one of these figures. He actually got a medal or award of some sorts from the Central Intelligence Agency
for bashing. Yeah, he got a medal. And also we learned from later declassified documents that he is one of the people that they went to and briefed on things. Right? Remember this presentation from Carmine in 2017 at Lancer, where we have documented, you know, points where you have different journalists, in air quotes, right, being informed.
You sure was Matt? Who?
Holland was one of them that they
really
were in contact with, yeah, along with Patricia
McMillan.
Yeah, you know.
She was one.
The lady who, you know, coincidentally happened to be in Russia at the same time Oswald was and interviewed him ahead of time, and then later moves in with
Marine Oswald. I'm not sure. I don't remember Max. Carmine talking about Max Holland, but...
Well, whether he knew about it or not, I remember discussing it with him.
There's another guy that worked for the Dallas newspaper.
Yeah, there was, but that's the point. There was a bunch of journalists who, you know, have for years run around and said, look, I was a reporter, I was there, and I know what happened. I mean, Dan Rather, his whole career is based on it. And he would, every anniversary that would come up, well, Dan, you know, Dan Rather, I was there, and I happen to know because he was who? Our man in Dallas.
The thing about the moment we're in now, though, is I think the CIA, everybody, it's not them, but even the media now has moved beyond the debate over is it a low nut or a conspiracy? Mm-hmm. They're not debating that anymore. Now, to give you an example, there was a, what I think's happening, there was a real interesting podcast that I sent you a link to it.
Right.
But Jefferson Morley did a podcast with Philip Sheldon, who was a, I think, a reporter for New York Times.
Okay.
But he wrote a book about the assassination about 10 years ago, saying that Oswald did, it was a book about the Warren Commission, saying how they got things wrong. So even Posner admitted they got some things wrong, but now they've gone beyond saying just that to saying, well, some things were covered up, because these files and the work of people like Jefferson Morley and many others have demonstrated, and you mentioned, you know, the Joannides story, that obviously things were covered up.
Well, so you can't deny that anymore.
Now there's explanations for that.
Sure.
That they're putting out there, and that is that, you know, maybe the KGB did it, so they wanted to cover it for that. The Sheldon character is saying that Oswald did it, but he thinks Oswald got help. And in his book, I forget the characters' names, but there's a story. I mean, it comes way back from the day of week after the assassination, or hours after the assassination. There's a Cuban that claimed that he saw a Castro agent give Oswald money in Mexico City, and a week was spent by the FBI and the CIA too, debunking this story.
Mm-hmm.
But the Sheldon guy has the story and doesn't debunk it in his book, and uses that as innuendo to suggest that, well, maybe this was a Castro plot.
Right.
So then you're supposed to think, well, that's why it was covered up.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I saw, you know, 2 weeks ago, I think Morley was on there, but if not, there's a segment of MSNBC I saw on YouTube.
Right.
The Morning Joe show, where they're discussing this, and they're talking about Joannides, actually, and they just pause. Well, this is all basically saying, they're not saying it's a conspiracy, but just showing how incompetent the CIA is how they're concluding it. So
sure.
That seems to be where we're at now. It's not about whether it's a low nut or conspiracy, people are crazy. But admitting that, yes, things were covered up, and now it's innuendo to make you think it's a justifiable reason to prevent, you know, a war or something, or it's just incompetence and just throw up your hands. I think that's where the media is at now.
Well, I think ultimately it's like the boxing, strategy where you just try and get your opponent to wear themselves out. You know, and they've attempted to do this generationally, and, step by step, each succeeding generation has continued to chip away at these different things that have been presented as the alternative answer, as the official answer, and we just haven't stopped. We haven't given up, but they do wear us out, and from time to time, you know, I noted that with the statistical analysis regarding young people. And they're slightly changing now trajectory regarding how they feel about this, right? Is that eventually you sit there and you go, well, look, is this just an academic exercise now? Is this not important anymore? Perhaps younger people are starting to think that. And I think that eventually that is the goal of all. I mean, how many people are arguing today about Pearl Harbor, really, and exactly how that all went down? And yet, you and I both know that there were several official investigations into how that really happened. Okay, there were many open questions regarding, was this, you know, something that, were there traitors involved? There were all kinds of questions about this. It is totally forgotten now in any sort of debate regarding the history of the 20th century. I mean, yes, I know there are some people, and there are also people that will tell you that the Titanic was sank as the result of, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But really, it's only now residing among the fringe people. There is not a major public debate. Now, JFK still evokes a public debate, still evokes public interest. And the only reason why it does is because of the efforts of people like Mark Lane, like Oliver Stone, who have kept it in people's faces all these years, right? And the hundreds of books you and I have talked about, we know about, we know some of the authors of. I mean, all this stuff has collectively continued that conversation. Pearl Harbor's almost, you know, it's over. There's no debate anymore, right? There's nothing to it. Also, all the survivors of that event are basically gone. I mean, there may be a few people alive that were alive at the time. But, I mean, truthfully, you let the generations die out, and you let the interest go with it, right? I mean, this is part of the strategy, obviously, as well. So, you know, we have all these things that we could discuss, and we're definitely going to get into it deeper in the next hour with Larry and Larry. But I'm thinking we could take a break maybe, Mike, and see if we want to change directions. What do you say?
Sure. Sounds good.
Okay. So stick around, guys. The Ocelli Effect with Mike Swanson in this hour will return after this.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that is
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain, okay? Because people want to support you, they love you to death, but honestly,
so if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show, and I want you to do this because. You know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination looked into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker
in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Segment number two of the Ocelli Effect for this Thursday, that is, here on, if you're hearing us live anyway, December 29, 2022. But you could be hearing us some other time, some other place, whatever, via your podcast feed du jour. And no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome. Mike Swanson is still with me, and we're going to get into a couple of other things, I think. But, you know, it's fascinating, Mike, headlines and things that are happening. Anything you want to cover before we move away from the JFK subject, which I'm going to have to cover extensively in the second hour. And you guys are going to definitely enjoy hearing from other people besides me on it. But, yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I want to talk about the news with you and how it's framed. And then we get to the current events. But I'm reading this interesting book. This is what I'm currently reading. It's called Deciding What's News. It was written in 1980, then it's by a sociologist, and he studied news broadcasts and also the news weeklies, Newsweek, Time Magazine, Life, to see how they framed the news, meaning how they what they thought was important, you know. And he interviewed all these, a bunch of famous reporters and so forth.
Right.
Leaders of the networks. And I want to get to how he describes, the news, but a little fact that I didn't know and never read before. It's in this book. He says, since we're speaking of the assassination, in the hours after the John F. Kennedy's assassination, network anchor persons and reporters frequently pointed out that the country was not panicking. Now, I know you know that because both you and I have seen, people can watch on YouTube, the network footage of November 22nd.
Right.
Well, he says this about it. Later, I learned that they were in fact worried about possible panics and immediately looked for stories which indicate that none were taking place.
Right. Well, and that was the thing. It was interesting to watch that because, a lot of people posit the idea that the news was, ready to go. Some people try to say, like today we've caught many networks, arriving on the scene of events before events happen. That's occurred. Okay. They seem to be in the know a little bit too fast, certain people. There are people that try to say that, the news knew about that day in Dallas, and it doesn't pan out when you look at what happened there. There's a clearly disorganized and emergent situation. I mean, whether it's the warming up of Walter Cronkite's camera, right? Remember that? You know why you always see that CBS news bulletin is because they literally had to warm up the TV camera. It wasn't ready. for broadcast, because you have to turn those things on ahead of time in 1963. The idea that they were trying to figure out how to patch phone calls, right, into the broadcast audio. They didn't know how to do that right away. So we saw that on NBC, if you remember, the little black box, and they're trying to put it on the phone, and it's feeding back. And they didn't know how to do this stuff. They weren't prepared. They weren't ready. And they tried to go live right away, which is something that they never did before, where it was like, forget it. All other programming has been canceled so that we can bring you this. Now, they had done something like that at the beginning of World War II, but that was only on radio. So this time we see it on television, radio, everywhere, and this is clearly an organic thing that happens. I don't know if you saw the presentation I gave, the University in Alabama regarding the media and the evolution of it on the JFK case, where I discussed this portion of it, that clearly the news media was not prepared, but became prepared after. And then later you could see that what happens when they had, you know, pre-prepared, organized, orchestrated things. And there is a huge difference between what they presented on that day and what they would present ever after regarding that. And you can also see that they learned based on a lot of the downfalls. I mean, there was actually, a lot of people say all the networks broadcast Oswald's murder live. They did not. Only one did. I mean, you know that too, right, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, despite the fact that all the TV stations, all the existing TV networks were covering his prisoner transfer, they were not all live on the air with it when he moved. Now, today, that would be almost unacceptable. If the media had access to the movement of a prisoner like that, every network, I mean, MTV would switch to it, you know? Everything would go to that. And you'd have multiple live feeds of it everywhere. But at that time, they didn't do that. So there were guys there taping it from the CBS, ABC, NBC, which was effectively all of your TV, right? They were all there, but only one of them actually broadcast it live. Some of them had to turn around and figure out how to re-rack the videotape that they just made in order to play it again a few minutes later on air. So, you know, there was a lot of things going on here. But it's fascinating to see how the media covered it. I love stuff like this. I'm going to have to check out this book that you're talking about the news, because maybe it'll explain bleeds leads, you know?
Well, one little stat that's interesting is the guy finds, and this is same with the magazines, they don't really exist anymore, but they were big back then, that 20% of all the stories, 20% of them, whether it's on television or in these weekly news magazines, were about the president. Mm-hmm. You know, just in some shape or another, they're about the president. And the way he describes, just to kind of sum up what's going on, mm-hmm. he says that what is it they're doing? What is it they're reporting on? In the end, it all boils down to this. The news is about people, but it's really about the nation and the persistence, cohesion, and the conflicts threatening the cohesion of the country. That's all of it's about that. And in turn, they define the nation as the federal government, and so that's why they focus on the president so much. And the nationwide and even local, institutions
right.
tend to be caught up and turned into national stories, or if they can, or they're simply completely ignored.
Well, this is about the nature of collective experience and what actually mattered at that time and what matters today even. I mean, it's obviously changed because of the method of conveyance that has, you know, become completely different. But yes, indeed, there was a need, in other words, to cover these things a certain way. I mean, you know, there's a need for that stilted stuffed shirt kind of, you know, presentation with the news and all that, because it really was about a collective experience. And I think the last time that we had, you know, something where there was sort of a single conduit for it, like television or radio that was, you know, people sort of got locked into. They needed to be at home. They needed to view this. And everybody was sort of called to it. The last time we really experienced that, I think, is 9/11. When everybody all together seemed to all go to their televisions, whether they were at work or home or school. And
oh, for sure.
And all of the television networks even seemed to come up with a collective idea that they needed to run, you know, the chyrons at the bottom, the news tickers. And that's ever after now just become commonplace to the point where I don't think people see it anymore. That was the sort of thing that only used to run on the financial network, where you constantly saw, you know, the stock updates. You know about this. And that was like the only place you really saw that stuff, unless there was one big breaking news story. But because the events of 9/11 led to a continued national interest and the need for absolutely constantly updated news, and the internet was not as it is today, you know, you didn't go to a Facebook, you didn't go to a news app, you didn't, so everybody tuned to the TV and you were being fed this constant reading and the constant reports and the constant coverage. And we went to, again, another version of the 24-hour news cycle, as opposed to, well, I'll just wait to hear about it tonight at 6 and 11. And maybe there's a noontime, you know, thing that I can catch at the bar or the diner on the TV there or through the radio there. It's a different situation now, right? So I don't know. And do we have a collective experience, or have we become so compartmentalized and less homogeneous, if you will, or homogenous, regarding this? Because is everybody truly interested in the same thing at the same time? Doesn't seem that way, but occasionally there are events that seem to, you know, call people together. And, of course, there are things that do affect us all. Maybe COVID is actually the last thing, which is funny, because I was going to bring up to you one of the minor headlines from recently, and we've only got a few minutes left, and I just wanted to see about your impressions of what's been going on since you and I last spoke. Which, by the way, are you going to be with me again next week?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Excellent. I'll love to start out the year, and I'm going to dispose with asking you about predictions for next year, although you could get into that if you want to in a minute. But I was curious if you saw this nonsense from another Hollywood nutcase, Sean Penn, talking about how people who haven't been vaccinated need to be locked up and set aside from society and not given jobs and all that good stuff. Mr. Core, Mr. I'm going to help the little guy, Mr. I'm worried about people spreading diseases even though I married Madonna. Oops, I made that comment. Don't blame it on Mike Swanson. Okay.
No, I didn't see. I missed this tidbit.
Okay. Well, anyway, it is some big statement from him. It's kind of gone viral, you know, and who gives a crap what Sean Penn has to say anyway? Although I got a little story to tell about that. Maybe I'll tell it later on this week or tomorrow night on the Friday night show. Maybe I'll tell the Sean Penn story. But forget that. Okay. So you didn't see that. I know you've seen the recent financial stuff. I know you've seen the, various things going on. I mean,
look. Well, I'll tell you something. I mean, it's a little thing I wrote this morning, but it's not a prediction. But if we just look at what happened this year, you know, I don't have to predict it, but we did predict it on your show, and that is the metaverse failed. It turned out that you know, a year ago, 2021, as we were entering this year, we were told that was going to be one of the big things. It was going to take off. Right. People would start to use it. Well, it turned out that across the entire world, there's a 12% decline in the sale of the virtual reality headsets that you need to even use it. So it's done the opposite of catch on.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, the sales are in collapse. It's not even 10 million people bought the damn thing.
Right. And is Twitter worth the money it once was? I mean, is it worth that price tag that Elon Musk picked it up at? Is he about to, you know, in other media news, right?
I don't think it is.
No, of course not. But
it's losing, you know, millions of dollars a day.
Well, he can lose all his billions there because all of his wonderful government subsidized contracts and his military contracting that's done under shell companies will do just fine. So I'm sure Elon will be okay, even if he does step down as CEO because he put it out that he wanted people to vote on that, right? Or maybe you weren't keeping track of that one, were you, Mike?
Well, he I don't know I don't think the question is Twitter valuable? I don't think it is. It's not, but, I mean, the one theory that would say he is got a plan and it makes, you know, he knows what he's doing and it's going to benefit him is that, look, we came into this year. Think about how the year, well, that was last year, whatever these crazy riots happened at the Capitol, you know, that after that happened, Q stopped posting and Trump got banished from Twitter.
Right.
Kind of fade away a little bit. Really, DeSantis kind of rose up, but Twitter, I mean, Q and Trump as phenomenons have definitely kind of fade away. Q certainly has. He stopped posting.
Well, for the time being, you know.
But the followers are still there.
Right.
You know, and they tried other networks. Trump made one, Trump Social or something. Truth or social something.
Truth
didn't
social,
really
yeah.
take. You know, there's a couple of people tried things, didn't really Parler. None of these things really took off.
Right.
And the movement of Q and Trump people were just kind of scattered all over the place. Nothing really happening. Trump's said he's running for president, but it's not exciting yet. If it ever will be, or if he's even really serious about it, it's hard to even tell.
Mike, have no fear. Look, season two of the Coronavirus Apprentice will return, I assure you.
Yeah, but we already got a new show. That's Elon Musk. He's gotten these people now.
Yeah, but
through his purchase of Twitter. Following him.
Have no worry. You know what it'll be? It'll be a merger where they're going to say, look, Trump doesn't have a vice president. Maybe he needs Musk instead of Pence for 2024. You got to stay tuned.
Someone else.
Well, I'm just saying. You never know. That speculation, I'm sure, will be out there sometime. Maybe Musk will be the vice president, or maybe Trump will go in as vice president this time. Musk will come in for a little while, and then he'll resign. Remember, that was, one of the things that some people had said, some of those Q followers were saying anyway, that at some point Trump was going to resign. Then they thought Biden was going to come in and resign and make Kamala Harris the first female and black, female black president, because he was just going to come in to win and then resign. They had a lot of different
I didn't become a Q follower because it kept changing too much. You just get a headache. Mm-hmm. You couldn't keep up with what you're supposed to believe.
No, of course not. And that's my point about this. I mean, next thing you know is maybe Melania will run against Michelle Obama. But it won't really count because the deep state's going to steal it anyway and give it to who? Hillary? I don't know. You know, you got to watch. You got to stay tuned to understand what the season two of Coronavirus Apprentice is going to be all about. And unfortunately for most of us, Mike, that does mean that we're going to spend the next 4 or 5 years analyzing and doing the after shows on that, I think. Well, maybe not you and me, but somebody will. So, Mike, I got to get going. Of course, I got to get to Larry and Larry. So, sorry that we ran out of time quickly, but you're going to be back with me next week?
Yeah, I'll be here. I'll be talking with you then.
All right. Well, let's...
Looking forward to your guests in a few minutes.
Oh, me too. And I'll tell you something else. I think we should really dig into what is going to come up in 2023 next week, because I dare say that things are going to look a little different and we're going to have something to talk about even stranger next week. But... For now, Mike, really appreciate you. Go to WallStreetWindow.com, guys. Be in the know. Go there. Sign up for the morning emails. They're great, by the way. Get you informed early in the day about what's happening and sometimes what's going to happen, too. Mike Swanson, author, website guy, WallStreetWindow.com, and also supporter of this show. Brother, I appreciate you. Thank you. Anyway, guys, stick around. Larry Hancock and Larry Schnapp coming up next on The Ocelli Effect.
nowadays we've all lost our common sense. Well, if this song offends you, friend, it's time to dry your tears and face the facts that we've all known for at least 1,000 years. Yeah, if you're born with a penis, you're a boy. And if you can have a baby, you're a girl. And if you don't like this song because you think what I'm singing's wrong, you're the dumbest human being in the world. Y'all, the government claims they care about us, but that's a pack of lies. You can watch them while they're talking, then you'll see it in their eyes. But if you completely trust them and you think our freedom's free, well, I hate to say it, buddy, but you're just as blind as me. If you're born with a penis, you're a boy. And if you can have a baby, you're a girl. And if you don't like this song because you think what I'm saying's wrong, because you think what I'm saying's wrong, you're the dumbest human being in the world. Yeah, if you're born with a penis, you're a boy. Everybody! And if you can have a baby, you're a girl. And if you don't like this song because you think what I'm saying's wrong, you're the dumbest human being in the world. I said if you don't like this song because you think what I'm saying's wrong, you're the dumbest human being in the world. Yes, sir.
That's the truth right there.
Like history, real history that you were never taught in schools.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War.
By author Mike Swanson. Jesus.
What would I do? Revelation through conversation. In a radio show / podcast. You want the good news? Listen to the Ocelli Effect. Chuck Ocelli is the most underrated voice in all media. News, education, and entertainment. The Daily Bread from Ocelli.com. Go there. Save yourself from ignorance. Ocelli.com. But we all agreed to put Ocelli.com on and listen to the Ocelli Effect. Revelation through conversation. Ocelli.com.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that is
the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly.
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this because, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com. Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
And so the third segment of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com and wherever it is you are hearing us via your various radio applications and et cetera, et cetera. And if you're catching us via the podcast, we do appreciate you, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, taking a listen to this show. Anyways, with the greater interest in the discussion on the show and everywhere else that I'm paying attention to anyway, regarding the JFK assassination, the recent document dump, which I think is a perfect phrase still to describe what happened, because I got my feelings about what it is they laid on us around that September 15th deadline and all that. You've heard from me on it plenty, so I'm not going to get into it anymore. Instead, I've got two of the best people possible to discuss this. I've got Larry Hancock, who is the author of many books. As I've said on this show many times, he actually occupies more space on my bookshelf than any other author, and that's because it is well worth it for Larry Hancock to occupy those spaces. He's co-authored some interesting books. Let's just give a short list because I've only got a little bit of time with both of these guys. How about Surprise Attack? How about Shadow Warfare? How about Creating Chaos? How about Someone Would Have Talked? How about, well, we can keep going, but I would advise you to go to Larry-Hancock.com. Check out his blog. Check out anything that Larry's written. I endorse all of it. Anyways, just one other thing, though. There was a more recent book on the Kennedy assassination that I often forget to mention. Larry, what is the title of that book again?
I think that would be Tipping Point.
Tipping Point, yes.
Fantastic book, by the way.
And that other voice you hear outside of Larry Hancock is another Larry, so this will be good and confusing and give me another reason to keep my mouth shut. Larry Schnapp, okay, and I hope I got his name right there. Either way, he's a lawyer, and I don't hate him, so that's interesting, because I do despise most lawyers. But this guy, look, I'm making jokes, but the fact is we've been talking about the lawsuit for the past few weeks regarding what? The JFK Records Collection Act, what's going on, why is NARA not doing its job? Oops, I'm sorry, Larry, this is my color commentary. Why is NARA not doing its job? Why have successive administrations refused to adhere to the law, in my opinion? But I think it goes beyond my opinion. So anyway, what do we have? Well, the lawyer who was actually the co-counsel in that suit, and I think you recently made an appearance on Tucker Carlson's show, didn't you, Larry?
Yes, I did. I went on Tucker Carlson principally because we've been trying over the last year and a half, our group of lawyers and researchers and historians have been trying to get President Biden to, you know, comply with the law. We also had sent a letter to Carolyn Maloney, who is the chair of the House Oversight Committee. Mm-hmm. And the House Oversight Committee, together with the Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs in the Senate, have joint jurisdiction over the JFK Records Act. And the last time there was a hearing on how the JFK Act was doing was back in 1997. Hmm. So in the light of President Biden's postponement in 2021 on the grounds of the pandemic, which is not a statutory ground for postponement, mm-hmm. And also because of the two Trump postponements, we asked, and this was not only just individuals, we got a bunch of open government or good government type of organizations to join in this letter, you know, historians as well, to have the House hold a hearing as to explore why the executive branch is not complying with the law. And unfortunately, there was no appetite in the Democratic held or controlled Congress to hold a hearing in front of or before the midterm elections. So the Republicans are taking over control of the House starting in January, and so I thought going on Tucker Carlson would be an excellent opportunity to try to get the incoming chair of the Oversight Committee, his name is James Comer, he's a Republican from Kentucky, to see if he would be willing to hold an oversight hearing. So I went on Tucker Carlson and actually, you know, basically asked him and his listeners to contact the incoming chair and ask him to have an oversight hearing, because it was clear that the executive branch was simply incapable of complying with the law. And last year I had filed a FOIA lawsuit that's under the Freedom of Information Act to try to get the underlying documents that were the memos and the emails that, you know, were generated as part of the two Trump postponements. And what I learned from that litigation, because the government almost immediately settled it, and they started producing documents about 250 pages every month for the last year. Right. And there were some really interesting nuggets in there. In fact, the National Archives had initially disagreed with the grounds that the CIA and the FBI were using to ask for postponements in 2017 and 2018. Now, your listeners might remember that both times that President Trump postponed the disclosure of the records, he did it at the recommendation of the archivist. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turns out, that letter from the archivist to the president, each one, the one in September of 2017 and the one in March of 2018, had gone through about 13 different drafts, and they came out of the National Security Council. And so basically the president just was told to sign the memo. I mean, when he went on Twitter 2 days before the records were supposed to be released in April of 2018, he said he was going to release the records. When he was saying that, there was already an order that was prepared and finalized to postpone them for 3.5 years. So basically, the National Archives was put in the position of falling on its sword. It did a complete 180 degrees at the direction of the powers that be, to go from objecting to the grounds to recommending postponement for 3.5 years and saying that postponement was consistent with the law. So it's clear that both President Trump and now President Biden simply, and it's the same process with President Biden. So they basically, their roles are basically to sign this order. They're told, presumably by the National Security Council, that this is the recommendation, and they just go ahead and sign it.
Right.
So we really think it's time to have a congressional oversight hearing so we can get the players who are interfering with the execution and compliance with the law, have them have to testify in front of Congress to the American people as to why 59-year-old records have to be still withheld. I'd also like to have them call NBC, which we can talk about later, mm-hmm. because of the things that NBC's been holding back, and some other private collections as well. So I went on Tucker thinking that this was going to be the right audience to try to begin that process of getting an oversight hearing in the House. Now, earlier this week, Judge Tunheim, who is he's a senior district court in the Federal District of Minnesota, and he was the chair of the Assassination Records Review Board in the 1990s, which was played an integral role in opening up a lot of the documents, and we can talk about them later on. But he had written a letter to the president asking for, you know, the records to be disclosed, and his senator, Amy Klobuchar, wrote a letter as well. So we're hoping now to maybe use that, her initiative. Maybe she can, you know, talk to the members on the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Maybe they can try to organize a hearing as well. So we're trying to dual path with both congressional houses to try to get them to have an oversight hearing, and plus we have our lawsuit. So we're hoping that between these three initiatives, perhaps, we may get some progress.
Fair enough. So let's try and now I know I usually turn to Larry Hancock for this, but instead, Larry, I'm just going to ask you to pay attention and jump in where you feel necessary. Larry Hancock, that is. I got two Larrys here. So jump in where necessary. But, Larry Schnapp, what I'd like you to do, though, quickly is to just give people an explanation, because now we know about all of these instances where this administration didn't follow through on that, and this one didn't follow through on that. And this is, you know, 30 years now since the work of the Assassination Records Review Board, almost, right? You know, and we're talking about the halfway point. Because remember this, talking about presidents, it's George H.W. Bush who signed into law the Assassination Records Review Board's existence with the JFK Records Collection Act, and it was President Clinton who actually appointed Judge Thunheim and the rest of the board members, right, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, we need to begin there. What was the purpose? What was the deal there? I've even had a listener say to me, well, you know, is it an act of Congress? Was it a law? What was this supposed to do? I mean, obviously you can't condense it all into just a few minutes worth of discussion here, but could you give us some a primary bullet points kind of thing here where it's like, look, this is effectively what should have been done and what we were waiting for now for 25 years, honestly, in 2017.
We have to go back to 1964.
Okay.
So there was a national, presidents issue periodically national security orders, which explain how the executive branch is going to handle, you know, classified information and then how it's going to be declassified. So there was an order in effect in 1964, actually 63, when President Johnson he issued his own order creating the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission, and so the order that was in effect was essentially President Eisenhower's order that had been slightly modified by President Kennedy. That order had identified the bodies within the executive branch that are allowed to classify, have original classification authority. And when President Johnson created the Warren Commission, he did not identify the Warren Commission as having the ability to classify their own records. Now, there could be records like the FBI and the CIA that gave the Warren Commission, but, for example, the Warren Commission holding an executive session, the Warren Commission deposing witnesses or writing memos or interviewing witnesses, all of those records, they were not allowed to classify them. And yet, the general counsel of the Warren Commission, Rankin, actually instructed the court reporters when they were taking the transcript of the executive sessions to classify them as top secret and also later on as classified. This came out in a little known hearing in 1975 that New York Congresswoman Bella Abzug held, where David Bellin, who was one of the staff attorneys for the Warren Commission, had indicated that they were not given the authority to read classified materials. So if they weren't allowed, how could the Warren Commission be classifying materials? Because these people weren't allowed to handle classified materials. He was just basically explaining why they never had the authority to do this. In fact, when President Ford created the Rockefeller Commission, he specifically gave the Rockefeller Commission the right to classify the information that they generated as part of that collection. So then we have the House Select Assassination Committee, and when they were finished, there were congressional records, and Congress has its own rules for classification, and the congressional records, again, those are records that are generated by the committee, not like records given to them by the FBI, the CIA, or other agencies. Mm-hmm. Congress, the House of Representatives, had its own rule for 50 years. So, when the JFK movie came out in 1991, there was an uproar because of all the records that, you know, were remaining classified. And Congress determined that the way the president, the executive branch, was interpreting the national security order and the way that they were administering the Freedom of Information Act was inadequate to allow the American people to learn about the assassination. So the JFK Records Right. Act was passed, and it overrides every other law except for an obscure portion of the tax code and except for some deeds of gifts. Those are the contracts when someone donates materials to the National Archives or to a presidential library, right, or even to a library in general.
Right. Now we're gonna have more of a discussion about the deed of gifts if we can get to it later, but I want to point something out here. That is that because the House Select Committee concluded its work in 1979, the reason why that date was set for 2029 that people saw on that slide at the end of the JFK film where it said that they weren't going to allow these records to be seen until 2029 was because of that 50-year rule you just discussed regarding Congress, right? So that's part of the equation. I've heard someone argue, and I don't know how valid this is, and this is a strange question, maybe, and I hope that you have an answer for it, but some of the Warren Commission members, by virtue of their experiences, you know, in Congress or Alan Dulles, for interest, which instance, you know, because the technical name of it wasn't the Warren Commission, although you could argue if you trace the activity there that it could have been called the Dulles Commission, considering how active he was. You know, the deal is, though, that Dulles maybe would have been eligible to be read in for these things based on his previous experience as head of the CIA. Things like that. But the commission as a whole did not have this power, even if some of the individuals might have been able to be privy to classified documentation, right? It's inconsistent.
Yeah, the staff definitely didn't, and the staff is the one that did all the work. The commissioners would get together.
Right.
Sometimes they would listen to, they would have executive sessions, and then they would sometimes, there was only, like, I think 40 or 50 witnesses who actually gave testimony before the commission itself, before the members of the commission. Most of the work was done by the staff, and they're the ones that didn't have the authority to handle. Now, Dulles is an interesting story because only in, I would say, the Seinfeldian bizarre world, for those who are Seinfeld fans, bizarre world is the opposite of what it should be. So when Alan Dulles and Jerry Ford were the two members of the commission that attended the most meetings.
Right.
Ford was a friend of the FBI, and of course we know who Alan Dulles was. When the then CIA director, McCone, and his assistant, Helms, were being deposed by the Warren Commission to indicate what did the CIA know about Oswald when Oswald was in Russia in 1959 and 60 and 61. Well, the person who was asking them those questions was, Alan Dulles.
Right.
So Alan Dulles was asking questions of his successors about facts that had occurred when it was on his watch. And not only was he asking them questions for which the answers he knew, but he's giving them leading questions. For example, what the CIA would, the State Department would be the one that would have had to tell you that, right? So he was like leading them down, the path there to make sure that they did not, disclose any secrets or any procedures, or they just basically made sure that the CIA was protected. So we have this Warren Commission materials improperly classified.
Right.
We have the House Select Assassinations Committee, is its own records are classified to the 1950s. So, and Congress is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. You know, they passed the law and they exempted themselves from the operation of law.
Of course.
So then the JFK Records Act is passed, and it's a very, very powerful statute because it basically says that all the agencies within the government are required to scour their files and find assassination records. They are supposed to then be given to the National Archives, physically given to the National Archives. The Assassination Review Board was established. It was an independent agency. It was going to determine what records qualified as assassination records, and then it would determine if those records could be disclosed in full. And the process that was set up was that, first of all, Congress said enough time had passed, 30 years was enough time, there would be a presumption of disclosure, and that there would be, a presumption of the goal of the statute was expeditious disclosure. So the review board had a very powerful tool. It could override an objection to a release by an agency. So, for example, if the CIA or the FBI had a record that, first of all, the ARB said was an assassination record, oftentimes the agency said, no, it wasn't. Well, then what was the remedy? The ARB would say it's an assassination record. At that point, the only remedy that the agency would have would be to appeal to the president. And virtually every time that there was an appeal to the president, the agencies withdrew their objection because the president's office of counsel basically said, guys, you know, work it out. So then the second battle would be whether the records could be disclosed or not. And again, if the ARB said, we're going to disclose these records, the only option at that point for the agency was to go up to the president and ask for him to overrule the ARB. And as far as, well, according to Dutch Tunheim, the President Clinton never overruled the ARB. So that was it was an independent commission, but it only lasted for 4 years.
Right.
And I don't think anyone really fully understood the size of the job that was before. They had some ideas about the size of the job, but remember, there were records scattered throughout, you know, dozens of agencies throughout the government. Mm-hmm. So no one really knew how many documents there really were. And when the ARB went out of business in 1998, their job wasn't done. They issued a final report in September of 1998, and when they went out of business, there were still outstanding search requests that were done, that were out there. If they had sent searches to agencies asking for more records, to search for more records. Those were outstanding at the time that the ARB went out of business. The ARB was also negotiating with the Robert Kennedy Trust. There were some records that Robert Kennedy had taken, you know, within an hour after President Kennedy was killed from the Oval Office. He had records, and then when he died, his family trust took over. They were placed into the JFK library, and the ARB was negotiating, you know, a release of those records when they went out of business. So even though they went out of business, their work was not finished. The statute says that the statute remains in effect. In other words, the agencies are still required to turn over assassination records to the National Archives until the National Archives, the archivist, certifies to Congress that the work of the statute has been completed. Mm-hmm. So from 1998 until 2013, very little documents were released. There was a couple of documents that the ARB had postponed for a period of time less than, well, I have to take a step back. The statute says that for any records that are postponed, the outside date was going to be 25 years from the enactment of the law, which was October 26th, 2017.
Right.
So at that point in time, unless there was an identifiable harm, not an anticipated harm, not a potential harm, an identified harm to national security, or somehow would jeopardize foreign relations, or it somehow interfere with law enforcement, or would pose a risk of death to people that are working for us, the records would be disclosed. If the president decided that these records still had to be withheld, he was required on a document-by-document basis, using clear and convincing evidence that the harm, first he had to identify in a non-classified way what the harm was and explain how this harm outweighed the public interest. And in the four postponements that we have had, neither President Trump nor President Biden has made that determination. They just made sweeping assertions that the records that are being withheld pose a risk to identifiable harm, and that it outweighs the public interest.
Right. Now, just to pause you there for a second, the thing is, effectively, I have stated on this show and other places that essentially the Trump administration and the Biden administration behaved in a very similar fashion regarding this by making these sweeping assertions and not being specific, as is directed in the structure here. Also, another quick note is that the Assassination Records Review Board should have gone out of business, so to speak, in 97, but was given a one-year extension. right, in order to attempt to better complete its work or complete a bit more of its work. Despite that, there was still work left incomplete anyway. Let's put it that way.
There were still records to be searched for and records to be reviewed.
Right.
Yes.
So with that in mind, Larry Hancock, if there is any context that we're missing here so far, I would love for you to provide it and give Larry Schnapp a break for a moment, and then maybe he can continue to explain this to us. But I'm enjoying the explanation because this is a lot more clear and concise than what I'm able to provide, and I appreciate it. But Larry, any other context we need here?
Yes, I think there's some very important context. Larry has mentioned the continuity of the work of the ARP. And that's something that's very important here, because the ARP itself and the people that wrote the Records Act realized that recovering history is an ongoing process.
Right.
You learn something, and that tells you where to look for something else, and you get that. That tells you where to look for something else, you get that. During the original procedure of the ARP, they actually held meetings, public meetings, and solicited input on where to look for JFK records, which was a very intelligent thing to do, because there had been a body of historians and researchers that had been wrestling with the Kennedy assassination for literally decades at that point in time, and they had learned a lot. And one of the things they had learned, and had been revealed particularly, I would say, by the work of the HSCA, were lots of areas where there were holes, areas where information had not been provided to the Warren Commission, information wasn't being provided to the HSCA. It's like, wait a minute, why is this not here? These are leads to new documents and new sources. And so the good news was that when the ARP began its work, it started taking recommendations on where to look for these things, and did a lot of excellent work. I mean, one, they explored the medical area, the autopsy, things that they might not have explored unless people had given them leads. Now, the thing is that the ARP did some wonderful work with that, got a lot of documents released. The JFK Records Act has worked to release thousands of pages of documents. But if you look at the span of time, that means these same researchers and historians have now had years and years and years to move forward. Mm-hmm. And if you really wanted to take this whole process to fruition, you need to continue the work of the ARP, which the legislation calls for, by having NARA undertake those duties. Not the president, not anybody else. NARA, and conceptually the Oversight Committee, can drive the process further to look at those holes. You know, what do we know? Where should be records that we don't find them? And why? Mm-hmm. You know, have they just not been released? Are they still being classified? Did they disappear? There's a lot of information that can be recovered at this point in time to do more and better collections because of what's been built on the original ARP work. And so I think that's obviously Larry's in a good position to talk about that, but one of the reasons that the Mary Farrell Foundation got involved with this legal action was literally to support the point that, you know, from an historical perspective, you don't stop looking. Mm-hmm. You learn more and you look further. And that's what the Records Act required of NARA, and NARA needs to be doing that, and both the President and Congress need to be supporting that activity. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Right.
And not only that, just to jump on what Larry Hancock said.
Well, just one second, before we move any further. Let us make it very clear, though, that the function of the Records Review Board, the legislation, all of that, is not in a technical sense to be an investigative agency. It is, you know, they're not investigating the crime. They're not investigating any of that. What they are there to do is to simply collect and make public the records. That's it, right? I mean, or unless I'm misunderstanding something here.
Well, that they can instruct, first of all, Larry's right, and it's not only the statute. When the ARC went out of business in 2000, the National Archives transferred the ARB's regulations to the portion of the code of the federal rules where its regulations are, and in doing so, the National Archives said it was the successor in function to the ARB. It said that twice, once when it proposed to move the rules, and second when it finalized that. So it is the successor in function, and what is that function? The function is not only just to review records, but to search for records, to ask agencies to search for records. And there are outstanding searches that are not been completed. And subsequent to 1998, when records have been released, we have learned more, and now there are more records that we think we need to look for because of what we've learned. You know, sometimes when you get answers, it raises more questions. So, like, just last, when we got the dump on 2015, we learned that the level of surveillance in Mexico City was much greater than we had envisioned originally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we also learned from Judge Tunheim that there was this, that this actually became released finally, that we had this joint program with the President of Mexico to wiretap, you know, the embassy, the consulate, and the Russian embassy. And as a quid pro quo for going into this program, the Mexican government required us to turn over all of the tapes that we got from these wiretaps. What does that mean? That means that it's possible, although the CIA destroyed the records, the recordings of whoever said they were Oswald, well, Mexico might still have those records. Mm-hmm. So we're learning, and the JFK Act, the Department of State, has a role to play. They are supposed to, it's the sense of Congress that they are supposed to help with the process of getting records from Cuba, from Mexico, and from Russia. Judge Tunheim told us there's 5 feet of KGB records sitting in Minsk that we have not seen. And they are records of the KGB's daily monitoring of Oswald in Russia. And as far as I know, except for perhaps Larry, the writer that wrote Oswald's Tale, he may have seen some of them. Did that ring a bell?
It rings a bell, but I don't think he saw those. Okay. He just interviewed. He did interviews with KGB agents. I'm not really sure he saw those documents.
Well, I do know.
But
I do know factually.
We know there's more documents.
Yeah.
Factually, so function,
Larry, really quick. Larry, really quick. Factually, I know that another author did look into the archives in Minsk, and that would be Ernst Titovits, who wrote Oswald's Russian episode, I think it's called. He actually looked in them because he resides in Minsk and was his friend while he was in the Soviet Union. So I know that he examined some of those records. I don't know specifically those 5 feet of records, but some of what is available at the KGB
archives. But the point is the JFK Act asks the State Department to try to help get those documents into the National Archives. Mm-hmm. And the State Department did not assist the ARB in trying to get the records from Mexico. In fact, I mentioned at the National Press Club conference that Mary Farrell had, Judge Tunheim had told us that there was this incident with Walter Sheridan, where Walter Sheridan, the ARB had identified his records as being assassination records. They were in the JFK library. He drove up to the JFK library, grabbed those records, drove down to New York City and handed them over to NBC. He had been an employee, even hired by NBC during the late 60s to essentially cover the Garrison trial, which ended up being the basis for the JFK movie. Well, the ARB was so angry about this that they actually prepared a subpoena to serve on NBC to get these records. and the Department of Justice refused to serve it. So there was ongoing obstruction from our own government obstructing this body that Congress created. They actually went ahead and sued the Sheridan estate, but then when they went on to business, that suit, ended. But there was another time when the ARB actually had an interview lined up with Castro. And Judge Tunheim was going to fly to Cuba and talk to Castro. And the Congress, whoever was in charge of the Congressional Affairs Committee at that time, I believe it was Jesse Helms, Senator Helms, said there is no way that a U.S. representative is going to speak to Castro, meet with Castro, and he kiboshed it. So at every turn, the ARB did an unbelievable job despite all of these obstructions they were facing. And it just shows you this: our government is not monolithical. I mean, even though Congress may have passed this law, the bureaucracy is entrenched, and it knows it can wait out. Like, it waits out presidents, and the ARB had a four-year, it was time-limited, so they knew they could wait it out. Mm-hmm. And, they just don't want to help. And so that's why Mary Farrell should not have been put in the position of having to file a lawsuit. You would think our government would do what Congress had asked unanimously to do. But it hasn't. And so, we're in a position where, we're going to have to go to the courts to get the government to do what it was supposed to do 30 years ago when Congress said that 30 years then was enough time.
Right. And there was a variety of resistance from various corners of the government. I mean, military records, I would contend that there were still as yet uncollected military records regarding Lee Harvey Oswald.
There's a bunch destroyed in 73.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another thing to bring it current to your view, to your listeners who maybe you're young, maybe they're millennials, maybe they're Generation Z, and saying, why should I be concerned about a 60-year-old murder? Well, right after the law was passed, the JFK Records Act, it placed an affirmative obligation independent of the ARB. It ordered the agencies within 300 days to scour their records for assassination records. What did the Secret Service do? It destroyed a subset of records involving the travel trips, trips, that presidential trip information from the fall of 63. So fast forward now. So no one ever got punished for doing that. Now, they were able to recover some of those records, but the records were destroyed. Nobody got punished. Fast forward last year, we learned that the Secret Service destroyed emails about January 6th. Mm-hmm. So the point is that this is not purely a historical event, that there are things going on now. If people get away with stuff, it becomes institutionalized, and they know that they can get away with breaking the law and not having to pay a price for it. And that just further emboldens the bureaucracy.
No, absolutely true, and it's fascinating because I believe people fail to reckon with the idea that, like, well, okay, so these are secretive agencies destroying records, and okay, what is the big deal here? Well, the big deal is that quite honestly, you, me, anybody who is an American, right, who has ever paid a tax, pretty much has paid for these things, in my mind, okay? And these are actually our records. These are not, the subsidiary holding of some other organization. If this is our government, these are our records. So we're either entitled to them or we're not. And if we're not entitled to them...
Well, they sort of had the attitude that Jack Nicholson had in the movie, A Few Good Men. Like, we can't take the truth, so they have to hide these documents from us.
Yeah, absolutely. So... Let us move forward, though. You have this lawsuit now ongoing, and it's not simply against the Biden administration, although they are mentioned, which is funny because there was a lot of debate about whether you could sue a sitting president, not too long ago, right? Well,
I mean, with different grounds. I mean, we're suing the president for failing to carry out his. And this is what the complaint says. He had, he had an obligation, what we call a non-ministerial duty, to carry out the law, and he failed to carry it out. And so we're suing him for his failure as an officer of the government. He had this obligation, and he did not comply with the law. So we're asking him, we're asking the court, you know, to issue an order requiring the president to comply with the law. In addition, you know, we are asking the judge to issue an order to the National Archives to do, to be the function, to do the functions that it said it assumed when the ARB went out of business, which is to search for records, collect them, and then, you know, disclose those that, that should be disclosed. And then we think there are other records that need to be, you know, we've learned, as I said, we've learned since 1998 that there are more records that we think are out there. And it's important for your listeners to understand that when you read things like, well, we've released 97% of the documents. Well, first of all, it's the information in the documents, not the page counts, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we Jeff Morley gave an example of a document from 1961 with Arthur Schlesinger writing a memo to President Kennedy. President Kennedy asked him for some recommendations about reorganizing the CIA. And this is a policy document. This is not like, you know, how are we going to spy on Russia?
Right.
And there's a page and a half of this document that's still redacted. In other words, it's blacked out. And this time around, they unredacted one sentence. And they're taking credit for that. Mm-hmm. But the point is that whatever percentage of documents they're referring to, that's not the right measure. It's the information. But number two, we still think there are documents out there. We have good reason to believe there are documents that are not part of the collection. In fact, and Larry, you can tell me if my number is incorrect. When the documents were dumped on the 15th, I believe there were 665 or 67 documents that were dumped, which were not previously known to be in the JFK collection. So like, okay, where did these documents come from? They were from the NSA, for Army Intelligence, and all right, well, didn't these organizations certify to the ARB back in 1998 that they had complied with the law? They had searched their records, handed over all of their records. Where do these records come from? And so it just, again, raises the, and they just like dump them in the middle of these other 13,000 documents. Like they're hidden, they hid this, the fact that they dumped these records. And so that just again shows you there are records out there that are not part of the collection. So anyone that says, well, there's only a couple thousand left, we don't know that. We don't know how many records are out there. We know the Joe Anides records that Jeff Morley talks about. The CIA always took the position that they were not assassination records, and therefore they didn't have to be turned over to the collection. And they are still sitting out there, not part of the collection. And Joe Anides, as we know, was running the DRE in New Orleans. Larry knows this better than I do. And, you know, that's the organization that had the run-in with Oswald that mysteriously was filmed. Yeah. So, you know, raises questions. What was Oswald working for them? What, how did they know this was going to happen? I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. How does that not relate to the assassination? It deals with Oswald. It deals with an exile group that was plotting to kill Castro, and there's suspicions about whether they were involved or not. And, you know, and they were involved in New Orleans. That's where the mafia was. I mean, there's, so the idea that they can just say these are not assassination records is just, it defies credulity, you know, and so, that's why we're, you know, so we're asking for, you know, specific relief. We're asking for the judge to give what we call injunctive relief. We're not looking for damages, you know, we're not looking for monetary damages. We're asking the court to make NARA do what it said it was, which is the successor in function to the ARB.
Right. And there are
successive, and also under the statute.
And there are successive issues, large and small, about collection here. One of my live listeners brings up the idea that PBS may indeed be in possession of a photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald that has not been seen by the public because they stated they had a photograph, you know, in one of their documentaries, right, many years ago, which is still yet to be seen. It's supposed to be a photograph, I think, of Oswald and Ferry that was not seen yet. You know, even Grodin doesn't have it in his collection, right? And that's a small issue, maybe, but it could be something that should be turned over, because it's not just the government agencies, although there are government agencies which have been seemingly resistant, have probably not, and have not been given any sort of oversight regarding exactly how compliant they were. Who would know this, and who would be able to track it down? There are many open questions, and I've even tried to provide the example that in a new document, if a new name is revealed, then that means we need to know about that name, and we need to get connected documents to that person. So there is a continuing expansion, of the universe of potential documentation, which is related to the assassination, which is ongoing. So the idea that you can even quantify exactly how many things or give a finite result to this is not even really, it defies logic. It's not possible. Yeah, Chuck, so Larry, go ahead.
Chuck, I'd like to jump in on that. And Larry pointed out that this really isn't a numbers game. If the average person hears like, oh, they've released, you know, tens of thousands, say 200,000 documents, you guys should be satisfied, right? Or, you know, you've got 90% of it, so, you know, that's the story. They're done. They've really been compliant. And that's really not true, and what makes that particularly troubling is that we know of documents, specific documents, that had to have been made. People have been interviewed. Jeff Morley has interviewed people from the DRE that Larry just mentioned that said, look, the CIA was paying us $50,000 a month to create propaganda programs. And when we encountered Lee Oswald in New Orleans, that's what we did. We did propaganda and it was good. You know, this is what we were paid to do. And of course we reported on Lee Oswald to convince these guys we were earning our money. Yet, we do not have a single report from the CIA files that discusses Lee Oswald, which is not, you know, is not wrong conceptually. That's what was going on, and you would expect to see that. It's not like that's somebody's day job. Another example is we know, and a CIA officer who was a domestic contact specialist acknowledged that he had done an inquiry into Lee Oswald when Oswald came back from the Soviet Union to Fort Worth, Texas. Well, that's what you'd expect him to do. There's nothing evil about that. That was his day job. Yet, we don't have his files with anything that mentions Lee Oswald. And these are the sorts of things that are troubling. None of that should have been suspicious. They should have been perfectly happy to release those files saying, well, these are just proof that we were doing our job. This is supposed, but they haven't released those. So there are troubling aspects of this in that it's not 200,000 that we've got. It's 100 that we don't have that should be there. And the question of why aren't they?
Well, the most obvious logical response would be because it would lead to yet again another expansion of what is required to be collected, right? It would obviously lead to, well, if you know that this exists, perhaps the information contained within would lead to more of what we would know would need to exist. I mean, that's all I can come up with for it.
Well, the other, if you wanted to be really cynical, it would be, all right, you had those files. Yes, you were quite aware of Lee Oswald. The CIA had been involved in watching Oswald, the CIA was quite well with Lee Oswald at the time of the assassination and had been before the assassination. So it gets really embarrassing when the head of the CIA tells the Warren Commission that they knew nothing about Lee Oswald. So is this just a matter of fact that you guys took all those files and shredded them or burned them because you didn't want to embarrass your director? Or was your director, there are some other less than innocent stories. I mean, we know that the FBI destroyed documents on Lee Oswald that showed their association with him pre-assassination. Right. We know that they rewrote part of his notebook. You know, we know that the FBI did that. We, at this point in time, we really don't know why we don't see those CIA documents that really shouldn't be suspicious. It's just suspicious that we don't see them.
Right. Fair enough. So, Larry, to bring this forward, though, I mean, there's a great many other things that could be collected, and it's just simply that we have a, you know, National Archives not doing the work that it said it would do. We have the administration not following through the way it was supposed to, meaning the executive, you know, the president, not following through on its obligations. What else is, you know, needing to be addressed here?
Well, I mean, I want to just be clear that, you know, for my FOIA litigation, I actually was impressed with the effort that the archives did to try to get the FBI and the CIA to release their records. They just didn't have the authority to overrule them. Mm-hmm. At least they didn't think they did. You know, I mean, I have memos from the chief operating officer of the National Archives to the CIA and FBI saying, we disagree with your grounds, and we think that this not only violates the JFK Act, but also is inconsistent with the interpretations of the review board. But I think, but you know, that's the good thing. I think they tried earnestly to try to get whatever records are in the collection released. Mm-hmm. What they haven't done, they've been very passive about, you know, new records and completing the searches. And someone recently, you know, we sent a letter on my letterhead back in February to the outgoing archivist Ferrara, and I copied the general counsel on it, listing a lot of the documents that we believed needed to be followed up on in the searches. And many of these search items that are in this letter became part of our complaint. Someone a couple weeks ago contacted the archives about some records, and the response they got back from the general counsel was, if you're aware of any records that are out, that are not within our possession, please let us know. Well, we've already told you that. So I don't know if it's resource limitations, but they definitely are not, that just like, if someone wants to give them records, they're happy to take them, but they have not expended any energy or resources to follow up with the ARB, and that's what they need to do. There's two layers here. There's one with the president not complying with his requirements under the law, but then there's the administrative law portion of this, which is the archives is they're their successor. They're supposed to continue to do what the ARB did, and then they're not doing that part of the job. They're not going out to the agency, hey, you got a letter in 1998 from the ARB asking for these records. What's the update? I mean, they've never sent a letter like that.
Mm. Yeah, that's, I don't know. Since 98, I think they might have had time to get around to this. I mean, yeah, just guessing. It's, you know, what, 24?
Not a priority. I mean, I'm sure that they, you know, that there have been records released. You know, the ARB set some deadlines for some of the postponed records that were short of 2017 or 2003, 2007. And there was a bunch of records released in the 13-14 period of time, and then some more in 17. Mm-hmm. But again, there was very little done from 98 until 13. Really just, again, passively, unless someone, you know, came to them, they did not exert any resources. And that's just not, you know, what we also want to do, we've also asked the judge to issue an order preventing the archives from certifying that the work is done. We don't want that work, because once they certify to Congress, it's over, the act goes away. Mm. So we want to make sure that there's not some nefarious action here where the archivist, you know, in June says, okay, all the records have been released. We think the requirements of the act have been passed. It's certified done, and the act is no longer in effect. We want to make sure the judge prohibits them from doing that until all these searches are done. And we're confident that the universe of assassination records that exist in our government, and you're right, they're in private collections as well. The ARB went to private collections to get records, and if PBS has some assassination records, NBC, you know, this law supersedes all laws except for the tax, that one particular tax law. I would argue, I don't think anyone has argued this yet, but I would argue that this means this law supersedes copyright law. It says it's superior to any federal law. So if NBC and PBS want to assert that, well, this image they have is, you know, is subject to, they have copyright protections. Well, you know what? The JFK Act says, too bad. We are entitled to that piece of paper. I understand that NBC, there's been some stuff in one of the boards about this Darnell film, that NBC holds this Darnell film of supposedly might show that Oswald was standing on the front steps in the back a little bit when the parade went by. He apparently, the notes of Captain Fritz said that that's what he said, and it was written off as one of his lies. And, you know, modern technology could possibly try to see if that face, that wherever that image is actually of Oswald's, but the embassy won't let anyone analyze it. So this is, again, you know, the you have private organizations that are obstructing the express will of Congress. And in the past, the Department of Justice was afraid to get aggressive with the news agencies. And, you know, I think the time has come to make sure that the private collections are, you know, that they turn over the documents that we need to make our collection, the American people, Congress said, are entitled to know about the assassination of their president. And this has got to be done soon, because a lot of people that lived through the event are dying off now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that the generation that lived through that is entitled to know the truth. Why did Jackie and Robert Kennedy provide, you know, for the William Manchester tapes to be postponed till 2069? In theory, Congress could overrule that. Whatever right. that deed of gift was, they could overrule it.
Well, right, and that's kind of the last, and that's kind of the last area I want to cover with you, because this does involve a variety of circumstances. Now, we brought up NBC a few times because of the Sheridan issue, but even CBS, who did volunteer some tapes and did make some copies of some of their material and hand it over, and some of that now resides in the National Archives. At a certain point, they stated they would hand over other things, too, because they have, you know, uncut interviews of, you know, key figures and things like this. They have a lot of tape. CBS does in their archive. But they stated that, you know, look, if somebody's willing to pay for this, we'll certainly, you know, allow you to transfer this material. That's something that I think was left incomplete as well. And
do you know that the ARB... The total ARB budget, I think that Judge Tunheim told us it was somewhere between $4 and $5 million mm-hmm. for the 4 years that the ARB was in effect. Think about how much we paid for the Zapruder film.
You're right.
And the way the Zapruder film was priced, it wasn't priced like a historical document. It was priced as if it was a collectible.
Right.
So it was, if somebody was trying to auction off JFK's clubs, right? It was viewed as that kind of document, and that's why that's so much money. That money could have been used. Again, but the idea that a news organization has historic information and they're going to hide behind their copyright, I think this is something for a hearing for, you know, Congress to listen to and decide whether this is the right thing or not. And I have two calls to actions for your listeners. One is that if you live in Kentucky, or if where the incoming chair of the Oversight Committee is, or if you have representatives who sit on the Oversight Committee, all you have to do is go up, is Google the House Oversight Committee. You'll see the members there. And if they're members from your state, I would ask you to write them a letter. Ask them to agree to hold an oversight hearing on the failure of the executive branch to comply with the JFK Records Act. Same thing with the Senate. The Senate's Home Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, there's a bunch of senators sitting on there. If your senators are sitting on that committee, write them a letter, same thing. And I would urge your listeners to write the president of NBC and ask him to release the Sheridan papers and any other papers that they have on the assassination to the National Archives. And maybe do the same thing with CBS. We got to start making this painful. We have to make this more painful to President Biden and to the private entities to make. We want to make it more painful not to comply with the law than to comply with the law.
Absolutely. And look, one thing I'd like to add as an addendum to what you just said is that, look, strategically, think about this, and I don't care which side of the political paradigm you like to agitate, you the listener, that is. Fact is that you can pick either side here and probably find a way to cause this to be a political issue that somebody could use against somebody else. I don't care if they fight with each other so long as they get it done. You know, and you have the Democrats coming out. You have Klobuchar taking her own initiative. You have the incoming chairman of the Oversight Committee going to be a Republican. I don't care. I think one way or another, any way to light a fire under these people, to give them a political reason to take action, is a good idea. So I say use it as best you can. But with that,
yeah,
all,
but we want to be tactical. And, you know, the old Arab saying about the enemy of my enemy, my friend, I would say, listeners, think of yourselves as the quarterback and you're looking for the open passing lanes.
Oh, yeah.
And whether the passing lane is, you know, the Republicans in the House or the Democrats in the Senate, it doesn't matter. But we I would love to be in a position where they're both competing with each other to try to have an oversight hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But the end game here, the big picture, it doesn't matter how we get there. We want a hearing. We want a hearing after all these years that the act is not being complied with. Congress right. anticipated everything had begun in 2017. I think unless we have a hearing, you know, Justice Brandeis once said, from the Supreme Court, once said, the best disinfectant is sunshine. We need a lot of sunshine to be shown on these, you know, the prevarications of the agencies, and how they're holding back. And, you know, if they can't, we have a problem of overclassification in this country.
Right.
And if they can't declassify records 60 years old, how are we going to declassify records that are 20 years old? Or 10 years old. I mean, this is a bigger problem here. But right now, for the readers, I mean, listeners, please, if you, if you have a representative on either the House or Senate committees, contact them. And then if you have another chance, Google the NBC president, call him up and say, I'm asking to have the Walter Sheridan Kennedy files released and any other files around the Kennedy assassination. They start getting phone calls. They're going to say, what is this all about? You know, we want to try to build a groundswell. We probably can't do like we did in 91 with the Stone movie, but maybe we could do something close to that. We want to make it, we want to put pressure on the people who are recalcitrant that it's going to be easier for them to comply than not comply.
Right. Absolutely. So with that in mind, I'd like to, give Larry Hancock a chance to put sort of a final word in here on this entire
yep.
discussion. And then I'm going to give the absolute final word on the show to you, Larry Schnapp, afterwards, if you don't mind. I know we went a little bit over here, but it doesn't matter. I think all of this needed to be said and explained. And I certainly want to provide you guys with as much as I can in the show notes. For you to take action. I'll also give you links to Larry's work, as I always do whenever Larry shows up on the show. Larry Hancock, that is. Larry Schnapp, actually, I'm going to provide your email address in case somebody wants a little bit of guidance about exactly how to write an email, say, to a representative, this kind of thing, the type of language, as you and I actually discussed
sure.
yesterday. So
yeah.
I'm going to include that in the show notes if you guys look down and check it out, you know, with the podcast. You can take a little bit of action here and get involved, and you never know, a whole bunch of little action. I mean, what do we talk about? A raindrop is not a big thing, but when it pours, things happen. So, Larry Hancock, would you like to give us something to consider on our way out the door here?
Sure. I think in case anyone was wondering, it's certainly reasonable. Why would the Mary Farrell Foundation, and I'm speaking as a board member of the foundation, why would you, you know, take your time, energy, money, which you don't have much of, to pursue an action like this? And I think hopefully we've drawn that out and made it quite clear that there's historical information that's our mission. Historical information is what the Mary Farrell Foundation exists to put in the public access. That's our mission. And obviously we have a problem here. If you can't get the information, you can't make it accessible. And I hope we've communicated that, and that everyone would understand why it would be worth our time and resources to support the legal action, because quite frankly, it's true that congressional oversight might work, but in terms of enforcing the full scope of the legislation and the full scope of what NARA could do if it was supported, we feel those that could be resolved by the court, most specifically, most directly, most immediately. But I would also encourage those that are following this effort to visit the Mary Farrell Foundation website. We have information on the lawsuit posted there. We have information on the document releases posted there. Within a matter of weeks, certainly, we will have a searchable base of all of the most recent data dump available there. So certainly, if you want to follow this effort, the lawsuit, on an ongoing basis, we will have the information front and center on the foundation website.
Which makes sense, because the Mary Farrell organization is the largest online repository of documentation of this type anywhere. So it'll make perfect sense that you'll have plenty of that documentation and the news of what's going on. Plus, there's some interesting things that reside there, including an entire online book authored by Larry Hancock, just coincidentally, as well as some other authors have published things there in addition to. Not just the historical documentation is available, but in addition to that, there's also original material there that only resides with the Mary Farrell Foundation. So that link will also be in the show notes. So, Larry, I really appreciate Larry Hancock. I appreciate you taking the time here where, look, I always let you get a word in edgewise, but we really needed to hear from Larry Schnapp tonight, and really, really pleased that you could come along and do this with me. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
And with that, Larry Schnapp, anything that we didn't get to, I think we covered all of what you and I discussed, and I usually don't do pre-show discussions, but I wanted to be very certain that we had an idea of what we wanted to cover here, and I turned to you because you're literally involved directly with this lawsuit. Your co-counsel, if I'm correct about this, is Bill Simpich, who has also appeared on this show before. This is really great to sit down with you. And also, really quick kudos to you in case people didn't see it. Got to tell you that the presentation by Larry Schnapp at the Lancer conference this past year regarding, guess what, precisely this subject was extremely informative and well done. So if you're going to go buy a presentation from over there or you're going to check it out online or whatever, Larry Schnapp did an incredible presentation with documentation and demonstrated a lot of what he discussed here and more, quite honestly, but bringing us up to speed. I really appreciate you taking the time, and the fact is I've now run you a little over time, but I think it was necessary to round this out. So anything you want to throw in here before we close the show, I'd really appreciate it, sir. And again, thank you for coming on and doing this with us.
Well, thank you for those great kind comments. I just want to encourage again, Bill and I are doing all we can on the legal side, on the political side. I know everybody, many of your listeners are disappointed. We still live in a democracy, and I really encourage everybody, we can do the way we can honor John Kennedy's memory is to make those phone calls or those emails to your representatives, to NBC, Bill and I can handle the legal side of things, but to get this groundswell of political support, like what happened in 91, we really need your help. And I just want you to know that you're disappointed about the release, like we are, but you don't have to sit and you can do something about it. What you can do is make those phone calls, send those emails, and that's the way that you can turn this perhaps into a positive. You're not powerless. We still live in a democracy. And, these representatives will listen to your voices. And if we can get enough of you to call in, they're going to do this. And the oversight hearing, I think, would just be an unbelievable event if we can get that done. So I'm just asking, readers, don't be despondent. Turn around and be proactive. This is what you can do to help the effort. And I just appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about this.
Well, right, and this is a more extended fashion than you were able to do with Tucker, say, but of course the audience is not as large, but we'll do what we can here and get this word out.
Well, you know, what people are going to talk to people, and, you know, word will spread. So we're trying different – the idea is that this is a bipartisan effort. We're trying every possible, you know, venue, and if you get to enough venues, you reach critical mass. And so this is one more – you know, venue. We so appreciate the opportunity to come in here, talk about this, and also, you know, encourage your listeners to take action, because every time we go on and we get someone to take action, it's going to steamroll, and that's what we need. So, you know, this
exactly.
is, again, you're Americans, we're Americans, democracy, let's get this done. Let's get this law finally complied with.
Right. And the thing to remember is, you know, the inciting event. I mean, there were people working on this for years already, but the inciting event that caused the Records Review Board to be formed in the first place, you know, was really due in large part, not entirely, but in large part to a slide that hardly anybody considered was going to be anything other than what? A postscript to a movie, a counter myth, Oliver Stone called it. You know, a Hollywood presentation. Now, there was documentation backing up that Hollywood presentation. But at the time, there wasn't as much. And it literally created this thing within the executive branch that the Assassination Records Review Board became, created a law, created a mechanism by which we could actually explore a great deal more than we ever had previously. So it is possible with public support and a little bit of agitation to your alleged representation sometimes, but the people that are supposed to be representing you, you do it enough, and they will find a way to take action. And I hope that you do that, because, after all, I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. I want to thank Mike Swanson, Larry Hancock, and Larry Schnapp for joining me tonight, and I hope that we have all learned something and will continue to do so. Good night.
Good night.